One tear escapes his eye. I watch it slowly slide down his cheek. "Paul," my father says to me, his voice still thick with a Russian accent, "we still need to find her." "We will, Dad." He checks my face again. I nod, assure him. But I don't think that he is looking for assurance. I think, for the first time, he is looking for guilt. "Did you know?" he asks, his voice barely audible. I feel my entire body quake, but I don't blink, don't look away. I wonder what he sees, what he believes, but I will never know, because then, right then, my father closes his eyes and dies. Chapter 1. 3 months later. I was sitting in an elementary school gymnasium, watching my 6-year-old daughter, Kara, nervously navigate across a balance beam that hovered maybe 4 inches off the floor. But in less than an hour, I would be looking at the face of a man who'd been viciously murdered. That should not shock anyone. I have learned over the years, in the most horrible ways imaginable, that the wall between life and death, between extraordinary beauty and mind-boggling ugliness, between the most innocent setting and a frightening bloodbath, is flimsy. It takes a second to tear through it. One moment life appears idyllic. You were in a place as chaste as an elementary school gymnasium. Your little girl is twirling. Her voice is giddy. Her eyes are closed. You see her mother's face there, the way her mother used to close her eyes and smile. And you remember how flimsy that wall really is. Cope? It was my sister-in-law, Greta. I turned to her. Greta looked at me with her normal concern. I smiled through it. "What are you thinking about?" she whispered. She knew. I lied anyway. "Handheld video cameras," I said. "What?" The folding chairs had all been taken by the other parents. I stood in the back, arms crossed, leaning against the cement wall. There were rules posted above the doorway and those annoyingly cute inspirational aphorisms like, "Don't tell me the sky's the limit when there are footprints on the moon," scattered throughout. The lunch tables were folded in. I leaned against that, feeling the cool of the steel and metal. Elementary school gyms never change as we age. They just seem to grow smaller. I gestured at the parents. "There are more video cameras here than kids." Greta nodded. "And the parents, they film everything." "I mean everything. What do they do with all that? Does anybody really watch this again, from beginning to end?" "You don't?" "I'd rather give birth." She smiled at that. "No," she said. "You wouldn't." "Okay, yeah, maybe not. But didn't we all grow up in the MTV generation? Quick cuts, lots of angles. But to just film this straight out like this, to subject an unsuspecting friend or family member to that..." The door opened. The moment the two men stepped into the gym, I could tell that they were cops. Even if I didn't have a fair amount of experience, I am the county prosecutor for Essex County, which includes the rather violent city of Newark, I would know. Television does indeed get some stuff right. The way most cops dressed, for example. Fathers in the lush suburb of Ridgewood don't dress that way. We don't don suits when we come to see our kids perform quasi-gymnastics. We wear corduroys or jeans with a V-neck over a T-shirt. These two guys wore ill-fitted suits in a brown hue that reminded me of wood chips after a rainstorm. They were not smiling. Their eyes scanned the room. I know most of the cops in the area, but I didn't know these guys. That troubled me. Something felt wrong. I knew that I hadn't done anything, of course, but there was still a little, "I'm innocent, but I still feel guilty," flutter in my stomach. My sister-in-law Greta and her husband Bob have 3 kids of their own. Their youngest daughter Madison was 6 years old and in the same class as my Kara. Greta and Bob have been a tremendous help. After my wife Jane, Greta's sister, died, they moved to Ridgewood. Greta claims that they had planned on doing that anyway. I doubt it. But I am